Hello and welcome to the Sierra Youth Podcast, a podcast where we hold conversations about creating a healthy planet for healthy communities. We're here to learn about all things related to intersectional environmental justice from the perspective of youth. Our hosts are Jackie, Emily, Jessica, Michaela, and me, Brenna. We have the immense pleasure of welcoming Laurel Collins to the podcast. Laurel is a member of Parliament for Victoria. She's also the NDP critic for environment and climate change and caucus vice chair. I'm not done yet. She's currently an interdisciplinary PhD candidate in the sociology department and educational psychology and leadership studies department at the University of Victoria. Previously, she was city councillor for the Victoria City Council. She co-founded and co-chaired Divest Victoria, which is a non-profit organization that advocates for cities to take their monies out of fossil fuels and put them into environmentally responsible investments, and also used to teach social justice and political sociology courses at the University of Victoria. Wow, we're so lucky to have her on the podcast today, and we really hope you enjoy the conversation. So Laurel, yes, can you, I know I talked a little bit about your background, but can you tell us a little bit more and also how you got into politics?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's really great to be here. And my journey into politics was, I guess, somewhat roundabout. I spent a lot of time as an academic studying social justice, doing research, teaching, and it wasn't really until a few things happened at the same time. One was Bill C-51, which was the Harper government's so-called anti-terrorism bill. Really, it was a bill that threatened free speech for environmental activists, expanded security services' ability to surveil Indigenous activists and environmental activists. At the time, I got my students to read the bill and kind of analyze it together to really look at the impacts it would have on mobilization and community building and social movements more generally. And it was kind of through that I started to organize in the community to try and stop this omnibus bill, and started to get involved with a number of local organizers here in Victoria. At the same time, there was a toxic soil dump about to be put at the head of the watershed of a community just north of Victoria in Shawnigan Lake. And that's where my mom at the time lived, my sister, my niece, and my nephew. And it was going to impact the drinking water for 12,000 people. So I started going up to Shawnigan Lake, standing in front of trucks, doing childcare for my sister so she could be out organizing with her community. And, those two things really moved me more and more into community organizing. And it was through the connections I made in those actions that I then co-founded Divest Victoria. So organization that was pushing municipal governments to take their money out of fossil fuels and put it into responsible, socially responsible investments. And I started going to city council meetings and meeting with councillors, organizing people for rallies. And I started doing more and more of that kind of community organizing, and my focus shifted away from academics and some of the other things I was doing at the time. And it was through that then the people that I was organizing with asked me to run for city council. And through a lot of my work on housing and on the environment, that then Murray Rankin, when he was retiring, asked me to run in his place for the Member of Parliament position.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And it sounds like you have worn so many hats, which I think is pretty similar with quite a few people in the environmental space. Like, you move through activist into organizing, and sometimes you go into politics or academia. So that's so interesting to know. And I know you mentioned you were on the Victoria City Council. So how did you end up moving from municipal politics to federal politics? Was it as easy as that? Like, you just had connections, and like, how was that process?
It was a really hard decision for me. And it was, when Murray first approached me, I kind of laughed and said, absolutely not. And I think the reason he was reaching out to me was because of a lot of the work that I had done on city council really aligned with the work that he was doing and with the NDP federally. But for me, I loved being a city councillor. I yeah, just really felt incredibly passionate about the work that I was doing when it came to protecting the urban forest and moving our city to reduce our emissions and also protect renters and ensure that we're building affordable housing in the city. And really, it was Murray asked me to speak to a number of people. And through those conversations, they all kind of in a different way asked me to think about where I could make the most difference. And when it came to the things that really I felt most passionate about, environmental justice, housing policies, I knew that at the council level, there were a number of people on council committed to those goals. And even if I left, they would continue on pushing for the same values and goals that I was pushing for. But when I looked at the federal government and, saw what the Liberal government has been doing, I did not have that same kind of trust that we were going to have policies that really work towards environmental justice and housing justice. And so that was the decision-making factor. I then ran in a nomination race, got the nomination, and then ran in the federal election. And now here I am.
That's amazing. And what have you found to be maybe like some of the similarities or differences between the two roles, municipal and federal?
There's something about municipal politics that is so close to your community, and the issues are everything from the shadows that fall in when someone is building a deck and the bylaws about how it impacts their neighbors to, I got emails about cats running through people's backyards, but also, about heat pumps and how we transition our heating systems in the city to ensure that we're reducing our emissions. And, I passed a motion to ensure that all bathrooms, all municipal bathrooms had sanitary products, menstrual pads and tampons, and ensure that we're addressing period poverty in our institutions. And so, there's such a huge range of things that it touches, and it there's some way in which it feels really, really close to the people that we're serving. And in federal politics, I spend half my time in Ottawa. And so the other half of the time, I just need to be out in the community, ensuring that I'm connecting with people and hearing their voice so I can bring it to Ottawa and really represent them. It's a really different job when you spend half your time in Ottawa and half your time in Victoria. And sometimes the policies and the, the debates that we're having in Parliament, yesterday, we were debating gun legislation, and there's a group of people who care very deeply about that. People both who have experienced the horrific impacts of gun violence, and people who are legal gun owners who have interests in and desires in the airsoft industry who, they're have kind of replica weapons. So there's kind of specific target groups, but for the most part, that piece of legislation it doesn't have the kind of closeness to everyday Victorians necessarily. I find that in my member of parliament role, I have to work really hard both to make sure that I'm in contact with the people who are interested in the legislation that we're tackling. And then also just, making sure I have as much face time with as many people as possible to really hear what's going on for people, especially right now when people are facing such, just high costs of living, inflation, the affordability crisis, the housing crisis, the climate crisis. These things are really top of mind for people. And I need to make sure that I'm hearing from them and hearing the impact so I can bring it here to Ottawa.
I love to hear how active you are in your community and how important it is for you to have that really personal connection with everyone. And you've kind of alluded to it and mentioned it, but I'm wondering more specifically, how do you connect with the people in your riding and in your community?
Yeah. So everything from door knocking throughout the year, definitely less in COVID times. In those in the first part, when I was first elected, I was out on the doorsteps a lot more. And since COVID hit, it's been pretty reduced, but also hosting town halls. And again, you know, we had lots of in-person town halls to start with. And then once COVID hit, we moved to a lot of virtual. We're now moving back into in-person events. Also smaller kind of community stakeholder sessions. The most recent one we had was on mental health and addiction harm reduction. And so I brought Gord Johns, who is the member of parliament for Courtney Alberni. He won the private member's lottery, which means his private member's bill was going to come up very early to be debated and voted on. And he chose to do it on decriminalization and a safe supply. And so I brought him to Victoria. We hosted a roundtable with service providers and people who are actively working in supporting people who use substances, and you know, making sure that we're hearing their voices when we're really pushing for this legislation. And you know, this issue in particular, the overdose crisis, has just devastated so many people in our community. People have lost loved ones, people have lost their lives. And we had kind of had that smaller roundtable, but then also went and did a tour of sites, safe injection sites, and also our place and other service providers like Solid. And I think the benefit of going door to door is that you often are going to engage with people who won't necessarily come out to a town hall or an event, who might not reach out to the office because they wouldn't think to reach out to their MP. And so there's something really, I think, beneficial about that, you know, making sure you're going to people. But then also when it comes to kind of topic specific legislation and issues, it's also really beneficial to host a space where people can come, and people who are really interested in that or who are doing work in that area can provide really direct input.
I love that you mentioned that that you're working on those issues. And I know the fact that BC is not criminalizing like smaller amounts of substances is so huge for the province and helping to protect people from overdoses. So I'm really glad you mentioned that. And I'm sure that's really come up when you've been connecting with people in your riding. And also, have you found, so like, what are some of the main concerns of some of the people in your riding? And do you find that that's synonymous with other communities in BC and also across Canada? Or maybe like, how is it differing?
Yeah, you know, here in Victoria, the things that I hear about the most from my constituents are definitely the housing crisis, housing and affordability crisis, the overdose crisis, and the climate crisis. I think those are the top three. There's so many things that people come to my office to talk about, and there are, you know, huge pressing issues. But I think those three are the ones that really I hear most often from people, and have such a just devastating impact. When you think about the housing crisis, it's everything from, you know, people who don't have a house, a roof over their head, and are living on the street or in parks, people who are couch surfing, who are precariously housed, who are in unsafe housing, or who, you know, are one paycheck away from losing their rental, and or who are being rent evicted, or, you know, who really are worried about losing their housing. Also young families who are being pushed out of the city because they have, you know, completely given up on ever owning a home here, when the cost of a house is, you know, over $1 million. And when they try and get into the housing market, they're being outbid by foreign investors. And, you know, our housing market, our rental market, it is just out of control and has such a huge impact on our community. And the climate crisis, well, you know, I think, in the past, people have thought about the climate crisis as kind of abstract. It is really here on our doorstep now. You know, it's more than, you know, choking on the smoke from climate fires each summer. It is also, you know, record-breaking heat waves where hundreds of people died. It is extreme floods where people are displaced from their homes. And this is just the beginning. And I think here in BC, we really feel it. And in Victoria in particular, I think we have a community who is acutely aware of how pressing this issue is and how it is, you know, we are in the fight of our lives. It's for our children and our grandchildren, but it's also our world right now, the livability of our planet, our food systems, you know, the biodiversity crisis. I think for a lot of people, the climate grief and fear that exists out there is really real. And yeah, we spoke a little bit about the opioid crisis, but it is, people are dying. And if it was any other issue, our government, you know, the federal government, while they granted an exemption for BC, thank goodness BC applied for an exemption for decriminalization, but across the country, people are dying. And if it were any other population, if it weren't substance users, I can't imagine that we would be addressing a health crisis in the way that we are, where we continue to let people die. It is unconscionable.
Yeah, it also feels like a big stigma too, like talking about substance use and also the interconnectedness with mental health. And I think they've been kind of thought of as siloed, but they're starting to be more discussions about how interrelated they are. So yeah, I think it's such an important topic, and I'm really glad that you're mentioning that as well. And it really sounds like not only, you know, environmental, social justice, it's all interconnected. And so that kind of leads me to thinking, you probably deal a lot with folks that have different opinions from you, or, you know, are not necessarily the easiest to get on board with environmental issues and environmental policy. And so I work for a conservation nonprofit, and at the beginning of May, I brought around 20 young folks from BC to the legislature in Victoria to lobby for Indigenous-led conservation in the province. And it was really interesting in those meetings, because they were saying, you know, there's so much money, or like industry has so much money to spend in these lobbying meetings. They're lobbying with us a lot, and they're talking to us a lot about industry. And so I'm just curious, like, when we talk about the just transition, like, how do you get those communities and those rural communities that maybe are more dependent on those natural resources and on industry, how do you get them on board with your environmental work and kind of mobilize them to kind of, yeah, I don't know, you know, help support the transition?
That's such a great question. And yeah, just to start out, you know, I feel very lucky to represent Victoria, you know, one of, I would say, the most progressive and environmentally minded ridings in the country.
Yeah, it's great. I love my bubble. Everyone has their like organic sourdough bread on a Saturday, like wearing exactly. their Birkenstocks. It's great.
really, really grateful to represent this community. And I think you raise a really important point. And that is, A, not everyone in Victoria is on the same page when it comes to this issue, but also across the country, we have people whose livelihoods depend on really carbon intensive industries. And until they see a pathway, until they see the jobs available to them that will be family sustaining, that are there for the long term, of course they're going to be scared. Of course they're not going to be jumping to lose their livelihoods. And you know, we talk about the just transition. And I think that, you know, oftentimes that language doesn't necessarily resonate with the people that we're really trying to support in that transition. And what we want is a jobs guarantee. We want investments in renewable energy, in the low carbon economy, that create those, you know, long-term family sustaining jobs in countries or in communities across the country. And, you know, this is something that I am working on right now, pushing the Liberal government. So we have a supply and confidence agreement with the Liberals, and there are 27 points. I think the thing that got the most media attention was the commitment around dental care. But there are 27 points in that agreement, and one of them is around the Just Transition Act. And so it's passing legislation in Parliament to ensure that we create a just transition for workers. We know the transition to a low carbon economy, it is already happening. People are already losing their employment in these sectors. And, you know, Canada needs to be a leader when it comes to renewable energy and this low carbon economy. And so, you know, that means actually making the investments at the scale and with the urgency that matches the crisis that we're in. And it also means ensuring that we have income supports for people who might fall through the cracks. It also means having bridging for people who are later in life who might not want to retrain, bridging to their pensions, ensuring that people, you know, who worked in that industry for years and years and years aren't left behind. And then we need the training centers. We need the training supports for people, many who have skills that are very transferable. You know, working on an oil rig and working on a geothermal site, that those skills are really similar. There's small amounts of training that need to happen in order to transition people into those roles. But we also need to have the investments in geothermal, in other kinds of renewable energy to ensure those jobs are there for people to land in. And there was a recent report that came out from the Environment Commissioner. So the government's own watchdog on the environment put out a report on how the government's doing when it comes to the just transition. It was a scathing report. It showed how they had failed coal workers in the transition and the lessons that were, you know, needed to be learned from that. But also, up until now, how the government's been doing when it comes to just transition for workers in the fossil fuel sector. And it was very clear the government is failing these workers. And it's no wonder that they're not on board when there aren't jobs there. When there isn't the training available, when there aren't the EI, the income supports for people who have a gap in their employment, when there isn't bridging to people's pensions. And so this is something that I will continue to push the government on. And luckily, we have a framework in which to work with them. So we're meeting with the ministers, we're creating a plan, we're pushing to make sure that we as rapidly as possible, and again, at the scale that matches the crisis that we're in.
That is so much to think about. You know, we're talking a lot about industry and oil and gas and the just transition. And obviously, it's not like you can just stop one day cold turkey, because then you're leaving so many people behind. And so I'm curious, is industry like engaged in these conversations? Like, are they trying to find out how they can like fit into this just transition? Like, what has your experience been, I don't know, talking with oil and gas companies?
Yeah. And generally, so I recently spearheaded a study on fossil fuel subsidies, and that's on the Environment Committee. And when industry lobbyists and executives come to our committees, I mean, there's a range, but representatives from organizations like CAP often are giving what I consider misinformation, and they do not consider the billions of dollars that they get in handouts from the government to be fossil fuel subsidies, even though they very clearly are, according to any international definition that you choose. And I don't see those kinds of lobbyists and those kinds of organizations really serious about meeting the crisis that we're in, or even acknowledging the scale of the crisis that we're in. And in my opinion, you know, the lobbyists from the oil and gas industry are really looking out for the profits of their shareholders and their CEOs, and not actually looking out for the workers who are impacted by this. And so, you know, this is, we are in a time when we are, our government is handing out billions of dollars to these profitable oil and gas companies in a time when those gas companies are making record profits. And at the same time, workers are suffering. And so, you know, it seems like a very simple solution to take those billions of dollars, stop giving them to the big corporations that are fueling the climate crisis, and actually invest in the renewable energy, in the climate solutions, in the supports for workers that we know are so desperately needed right now.
Really quick. So what comes to my mind is Bay du Nord and how that was just given the go ahead. And so I know Jill Bull kind of said, you know, it'll be really difficult for oil and gas companies to be able to have their proposals like checkmarked green light in the future after this project. And it really just feels like it's always like, oh, but this one, and then we're done. Or, you know, this one, and then we'll slow down. And so, yeah, how are you feeling about the expansion of oil and gas projects in Canada, in like offshore oil drilling?
It's just completely hypocritical. And it, you know, it is so typical of the Liberal government. You know, they Back when TMX was being approved or not, they declared a climate emergency, and within 24 hours, reapproved the TMX pipeline. They bought a pipeline to expand tanker traffic sevenfold to, increase production of bitumen. It is wild. And then similarly, we got a dire warning from the IPCC. How many more dire warnings do we need from the world's top, climate experts? The world's top scientists are telling us we cannot continue to increase production. And days later, this Liberal government approves Bay du Nord to increase production. It's mind-boggling. And the disconnect between what they say and then what they do. I was in Spain for COP25, and I had the amazing honor to meet Greta Thunberg and then watch her speak afterwards. And, she talked about the politicians, the oil executives, the people who talk about climate leadership, but fail to take the action needed to address the crisis. And that we used to have to deal with climate denial, but now we have this new kind of climate denial that is acknowledging that we're in a climate crisis, but not doing anything about it. And that is what I see again and again from this Liberal government, is that they are very willing to talk the talk, but they are absolutely unwilling to take the steps necessary. We cannot continue to increase production and meet our climate targets. And of course, we've missed every single climate target that we've ever set in Canada. And so it is not surprising that we are barreling towards missing more climate targets. And if it were just about missing targets, maybe that wouldn't be so bad. But this is about the very livability of our planet. It is about our future, it's about our children, it's about food systems, it's about, everything that we hold most dear. And it is just so disheartening to see that kind of cynical politicking.
And the young folks, especially, I know there are so many youth on the front lines of climate action because it's their very futures that they're worried about and the generations that come after them. And oftentimes it kind of feels as though, you might not be here when I'm really dealing with all of this, but this is going to be my reality and I'm doing everything I can. And so we talk about, just transition and supporting workers. And I'm just kind of curious, since we're the Sierra Youth Podcast and we're focused on youth, we often feel that young folks are not really included in these decision-making spaces. They're not really given enough access to government. So are you doing anything to change this? Is this top of mind for you?
Absolutely top of mind for me. And I think, you hit the nail on the head. Young people are the ones who are going to be living this reality in the future, and their voices are not heard in government, not in the way that would make a meaningful difference. For me, I try and meet with young folks as often as possible, try and give them as much access to me. But I think honestly, we need to do so much more. And one of the big pieces of our platform, and something that I've been really inspired seeing the mobilization around, is the Youth Climate Corps. This is, as we see more and more people being radicalized to the right, as we see this kind of right-wing surge that seems to be happening, lots of people getting excited about Pierre Poilievre, who was, a minister in the Harper government, does not in any way want to meaningfully address the climate crisis. I don't see him as someone who genuinely has the best interests of Canadians at heart. It is a scary, scary thing. I think we need ways to mobilize young people and to get young people engaged and excited. There are so many young people right now who are already mobilized, who are already organizing, who are marching in the streets, who are doing incredible things. But we also have young people who are feeling disengaged, who are feeling despondent, who And I get it, because when I think about the scale of this crisis and what the future holds, it is scary. And so the idea of a youth climate corps would be a way to have jobs for young people, have a way for young people to step into environmental leadership supported by the government, and everything from ensuring that Indigenous young people have the investments in guardian programs, in supports for them taking leadership in their communities and stewarding their lands, to ensuring that we have conservation jobs across Canada, to in the same way we talk about a just transition when we're thinking about engaging fossil fuel workers, we also want to create jobs for a whole generation of people who want to make a difference. And, the idea of a core, a climate core, is really a way for people to be engaged in the meaningful fight. This is the existential threat of our time. It is something that I think can mobilize people and can create a space to really make a meaningful difference. Yeah, and that is an incredible idea, but we actually need a government that will fund that at the scale that would make it happen. Just thinking about the We Charity scandal, they were willing to, commit $1 billion, close to $1 billion, to hand over, in a sole source contract that clearly was not a good use of funds. Why not put that kind of money into a climate corps that could make a real difference and could engage young people in a meaningful way?
That leads me really seamlessly to my last question, and then we have a few rapid fire questions, but you just answer them in one sentence. So it's like bing, bang. So you mentioned Indigenous youth, and I think from my perspective, I'm a root systems I'm like a root problem person. So I'm like, I don't want a band-aid solution. I want to get to the root of this. And so sometimes that often means like implementing solutions slower than maybe you would think, because there's so much more to consider. And so what role does decolonization and social justice play in your work?
Oh, that's such a great question. And I feel like there can't be climate justice without justice for Indigenous peoples. It is a foundational component. And so it needs to inform all of the work that we do. I just feel like we are so far from actually achieving justice for Indigenous people, and our government continues to perpetuate harm. There have been small steps when it comes to addressing boil water advisories, but yet still there are communities who have been without clean drinking water for decades. There have been small steps in acknowledging the harms of residential schools, but still we have communities who are finding unmarked graves, who need the support from government to address the ongoing legacy of colonialism. And then we also have fossil fuel projects that trample Indigenous rights. And our government continues to talk about upholding the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but isn't actually walking the walk. And, I think about the calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, 94 calls to action that should have been implemented already and should be rapidly being implemented, but aren't. The calls for justice in the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls report, which has really sat on the shelf. And, my colleague Leah Gazan has been a champion on this, raising this in the House. And our caucus has been raising this. I think really we are currently the only party really committed to pushing for the calls for justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And it is just so disheartening to see a government who, again, talks the talk but won't actually walk the walk. And I think Yeah. One of the things that we need to really do in all of our climate justice work, in the just transition work, in any of this, any of our moving forward, is ensure that not only are Indigenous people, Indigenous communities at the table, but they're actually supported in leading the conversations from the very beginning. But I wanted to touch quickly on what you said just about slowing down. And I think there's a huge benefit in ensuring that upholding Indigenous rights is at the foundation of all the work we do. And we need to ensure that we are still moving with the urgency and matching the scale of action required, both when it comes to addressing injustices for Indigenous people and when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. And those two things are so interconnected.
Thank you. I know it's such a, it's like a question that you need more time for. So rapid fire, have like four questions, answer them in one sentence. And then we will send you on your way. So being a leader means?
Listening.
Oh, I like that. What is something that people often get wrong about you?
My age.
Love it. What's the last show or book that you binged and loved?
I just finished a book called 4,000 Weeks. And it is, so 4,000 weeks is the number of weeks that you have in an average lifetime. And it is about how to, in some ways, make the most of those 4,000 weeks, but in other ways, to let go of our kind of capitalist and colonial ideas of what making the most of those weeks means. It was really a valuable book, both in terms of digging into the kind of theory of how our world is structured in terms of time, how we are the time that we live, how to kind of be present in the moment, and also some really tangible pieces around how to structure our kind of compulsive desire to make the most of our time.
Oh, that sounds like my type of book. I'm very excited to put that on the list. Give us a snapshot of an ordinary moment in your life that brings you joy.
The first thing that popped into my mind is my daughter, Alora, and her having just laughing fits. And so she is just one of the happiest, most joyful beings that I've ever experienced. And she is so easy to be present in the moment with her. And she is, yeah, just both the light of my life, but also this strong, powerful motivation to fight for all of the things that I feel like matter most.
This episode of the Sierra Youth Podcast was produced by Aviva Lessard. Our editor is Justine Van Dyke, graphic design by Zaria Levy, social media support by Abby Ganyong. The rest of our team includes me, Brynna Cagal-Vizantin, Emily Markham, Jackie Layton, Jessica Cloutier, Michaela Yanni, and Sean Trainer. We're the youth chapter of the Sierra Club Canada, a national and grassroots nonprofit dedicated to protecting our environment, our communities, and our common futures. We're a community-powered show and need your direct support to continue empowering young people to learn more about topics often sidelined by the mainstream media. So if you value our conversations and the guests we learn from, you can support us on Patreon. You can follow the link in our show notes to contribute, and you might even find a few extras in there. Other ways to support us include subscribing to our feed, leaving a review, and following us on Instagram. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. See you next time.